And now, back to Brainstorming with Billy.
It turns the brains into guacamole.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Welcome back. The theme is manifesting values. Each of my guests is describing and explaining why and how we exhibit certain values. My first guest is widely recognized as the expert on consumer psychology, especially among tweens, teens, and 20-somethings. We explored the values young people exhibit in the purchases that they make. My second guest is an expert in spirituality, integrative medicine, and mind-body connection. She holds a doctorate in medical science from Harvard Medical School. We discussed burnout and how to recover from it based on her latest book titled Fried. My next guest is a senior writer at Entertainment Weekly. She's an expert in the television business in general and youth culture in particular. And if you want to join the conversation, you can always call us at 639-0008. Jennifer Armstrong is the senior writer for Entertainment Weekly. She provides pop culture commentary for CNN, VH1, Fox News Channel, and ABC. Her writing has been featured in Salon, MTV.com, Glamour, Budget Travel, and the Chicago Sun-Times. She also co-founded and runs SirensMag.com, an alternative online women's magazine. Her latest book is titled Why? Because We Still Like You, the behind-the-scenes look at the Walt Disney's Mickey Mouse Club in the 1950s. Welcome to the show, Jennifer. How are you today?
I'm great. How are you?
Well, I am just terrific. Thank you so much for being our guest today. Many of the people listening to the sound of our voice are baby boomers, grew up with the Mickey Mouse Club, obviously have fond memories of it as well. And your book, I think, just for that reason alone, is something that they want to take a look at. The pictures, the text, the interviews that you have done with them, and just phenomenal job. But in the book, you contend that the Mickey Mouse Club was really a pop culture phenomenon. So what is it about the Mickey Mouse Club that really stands out in TV history, and why does that legacy remain today?
Well, there's a couple different reasons. I mean, there's some very specific, obvious indicators that this is sort of an iconic show, those being the ears. The ears were invented for the show. They were sort of one of those, you know, going to get, and a lot of the kids even thought these are the weirdest things we've ever seen, which if you think about it out of context, if you had seen those for the first time, they are very strange. And they were based on a cartoon that one of the adults in charge remembered where Mickey sort of tips his hat, his ears to Minnie like a hat. And they said, oh, that might make a cute hat. So that's one of them. And now that, you know, as we all know, they still sell those at Disney World and Disneyland today and have made gazillions of dollars off of those.
Sure.
And they're incredibly iconic. And the other big part of that is the theme song. You know, I'm pretty sure that even still people younger than I am, and I'm 36, I wasn't alive when this show was on, can sing the theme song. I'm pretty sure even like my younger siblings in their 20s can sing this theme song. They have no idea why.
But
they have no idea where it came from. But it's so catchy and so iconic that, you know, it just transcended the show. It's kind of amazing. And the ideas like roll call and Nat Funicello was a huge star from the show. Even the uniforms they wore, the sweaters and the skirts and that sort of thing. They're all sort of really indelibly etched in kind of the collective pop culture memory to the point where some people who don't even know where they came from know about these things.
No, that is so true. It is very iconic. And for fear of offending my listeners, I'm not going to hum the theme song, but it is very memorable. That's true. All right. Well, Jennifer, you wrote the book in an unusual way. You constructed the book as an oral history from talking to the original Mouseketeers, which presents certain challenges when you're doing this: faulty memory, conflicting stories about the same incident, revisionist history, that kind of stuff. Why did you decide to write the book this way, and in what ways does it make the history more compelling if you tell it this way?
Well, you know, you're right. It's interesting, and I was a little nervous at first because I thought, you know, this is a long time ago. This is 60 years ago, and, you know, if you think about your own youth, you know, these kids were maybe third grade through sixth or seventh grade mm-hmm. when they started. Think about your own life during that time and how much you could possibly remember. It's really tough, and you sort of do have a lot of revisionist history going on top of which they were very famous at the time. But between kind of talking to all of them, and then I did a lot of reading about it. I did a lot of book research. So I tried to sort of bring it all together in a way the best that I could with my journalistic training to make a comprehensive narrative. I like to read narratives. I think they're more compelling. So I wanted as much of a narrative history of this as possible. And I think it's a really interesting story to tell about really our first big tween stars, even though tween was not a word we used then, you know, preteen stars. It's such an interesting concept to me, just in general, so the idea of being a star at such a young age. I mean, we all wanted to be, but, you know, it's an entirely different ball game when you actually do it. And I just thought it'd be really interesting to sort of tell their life stories at this point. That's really what it is. And what I found is that a lot of times, almost all of the time, this one little window of like 3 years they were on this show really, really affected everything that happened to these people afterwards. And I think that that's so interesting. And then, you know, I think the best you do the best you can do. There's a very prominent note at the beginning of the book saying, here's how I did this. Take it for what you will. I actually think the conflicts are really interesting too. That was one of my favorite parts, is sort of the conflicting tellings of certain incidents. One of my favorites being that three different Mouseketeers tell the precisely exact story, inserting their own details. But basically the idea is that, you know, they ran into Walt Disney on the lot. He said, he greeted them by name. He said, hi, Lonnie, or hi, Sherry. And they were super excited, ran back to tell their parents, oh my gosh, mom, you know, Walt Disney knows my name. And then the mother figure in the story always says, oh, darling, aren't you silly? Look at your shirt. And of course, they wore those iconic sweaters with their name in like giant type across them. So of course he knew their name.
Yeah.
So that was one of my favorite conflicting stories. That it's not conflicting. It's actually three different Mouseketeers have claimed that story. Things like that happened a lot. And, you know, some people say Walt was around a lot, others don't. And I think the best you can do is just point out the conflicts and then tell the rest of the story. I also think it's interesting, the way we remember stories might be almost more telling than the way that they perhaps actually happened. And I think as long as you're indicating that this is people's memories of the situation instead of presenting it as straight on indisputable fact, I think that that's the best you can do to sort of retell history.
Oh, that's great. We're talking to Jennifer Armstrong, everybody. She's written a book, Why? Because We Still Like You. It's the oral history of the Mickey Mouse Club. And Jennifer, there was so much in that answer, but I want to return to something that you said about Walt Disney and the impact that he had. Clearly, those three Mouseketeers remember their meeting with Mr. Disney. But what imprint did Walt Disney put on the Mickey Mouse Club, and in what ways are his values imbued in the program?
That's a really important question, and it's two very different answers to those two parts of the question. The first part is a very straightforward answer, which is, my impression is that he's very involved in the show itself. You know, this was an extremely busy time for Mr. Disney. He was building and launching his absolute dream project of all dream projects, which was Disneyland.
Mm-hmm.
Huge undertaking.
Mm-hmm.
This was all he wanted to do. Of course, his people were still putting out his movies as well, and that was a very big deal, but really, really focused on this park. And the reason that this show came into existence is because he really needed a bunch of money for this park. And I always say, believe it or not, you know, Disney did need money at some point. I know it's hard to believe, but, you know, he needed a bunch of money. They were like, well, you know, these networks keep bugging us to do some TV. Why don't we go to them and see if we can get some money? So this was kind of like a backwards deal. It wasn't like he conceived a television show and then sold it, you know, and had this great vision. It was more like they were like, crap, we need some money. He sent his brother out there, pitched them some shows. The first one that ABC ended up taking was called Disneyland, and it was sort of an anthology show that did behind-the-scenes stuff and also gave us, like, Davy Crockett, which was a very big deal at the time.
Yes.
And then the second show from that deal was the Mickey Mouse Club, and it was described very vaguely. It was like, I don't know, maybe we'll sing some song, have some kids singing some songs or something at Disneyland. You know, that was sort of the concept of the show. It was really left to his people to flesh out what it was actually going to be. It was a very big deal that they ended up deciding to have a very large cast of children led by just two adults. It was 24 children the first season. And that was what made it such a big deal is, you know, it was kids entertaining kids, and kids had never seen that. So they loved it. So that, you know, all of that happened kind of independent of Mr. Disney himself.
All right.
Aside from him saying, let's do it.
All right. Now, before we go on to the second part of the question, then, Jennifer, let me stop you right there. We're talking to Jennifer Armstrong, everybody. The book is titled Why? Because We Still Like You. The cynic in me says, all right, Walt Disney wasn't too involved. He was definitely focused on Disneyland. But really, this show, the Mickey Mouse Club, was designed as a promotion for Disneyland. And he integrated the Mickey Mouse Club and Disneyland, particularly in the opening days, very tightly. So it's hard for me to decide when the Mickey Mouse Club stood on its own as a television show for raising money versus this is a promotional vehicle, sort of an in-show placement for my theme park, Disneyland.
Yes, absolutely. This is another huge part. And actually, to me, all of these things, even though he wasn't intimately involved in the details of the show, show the genius of the sort of Disney concept overall, which is, yes, not only was it a vehicle to get the money, it was twofold. It was also a way for him to promote the park. Notice in both Disneyland, the show, and this show, there was ample opportunity to market his park to the audiences. And that is really key, as he thought, not only do I want to get money for these shows, but I'm also going to make sure they're promotional vehicles for my park. And lo and behold, they were huge hits, which is kind of hysterical if you think about it. Like, that's really, really a lot of very smart business thinking there that goes beyond just entertaining people, you know, goes beyond just your art.
And it shows the magical touch that Walt Disney had, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, and if you look at his company today, it kind of still do the same thing. It's just in modern times. So he really had a very strong vision and executed it. And there's a reason he's a business icon, you know, that it's not just entertainment. It's not just his art. It's a business sense that really took marketing pop culture beyond anything people had seen before.
That it does. We're talking to Jennifer Armstrong, everybody. Jennifer, let's do a roll call if we can, please, because you have stories about so many of the Mouseketeers, and I'm going to start with obviously the most memorable of them, Annette Funicello. You know, in your book, what did you uncover about Annette, and what did you find interesting about the stories that were told about her?
I think she's a really fascinating pop cultural figure. I was sad that I was not able to talk to her. She's been suffering from multiple sclerosis for quite some time, 20 years since she's been diagnosed. So she is no longer able to give interviews, which is a shame, just because I felt like I would have been so lucky to meet her. The people that I talked to, I don't know if I've ever heard more nice things about a person that sounded so genuine. You know, I really believe these people when they say they love her so much.
Wow.
She's just really interesting. She was kind of the breakout star for sure, almost from the beginning, and it was something no one expected. She had not set out to be a big child star. She was just minding her own business, kind of doing, you know, her dance classes. She had done some modeling. I mean, I don't want to play it down too much. She had done a little bit, but she really was just kind of minding her own business in ballet class and did this recital. And Walt Disney, this is the one time he really stepped into the show. He handpicked her. And it clearly shows his eye for talent because, you know, almost instantly she was getting way more mail than everybody else. And she just, there's something, it's one of those magic of the camera kind of deals. You know, she wasn't, and I can say this only because she's said it over and over again, she wasn't the most talented of all of the Mouseketeers. You know, there were Mouseketeers with better voices. There were probably Mouseketeers who could even act better, but she was so natural on camera. She's beautiful. She's striking. She's beautiful in a different way than people were used to. She wasn't the typical sort of blonde-haired, blue-eyed American girl.
Right.
You know, she just really stood out, and I think it's actually just her sort of core sweetness that was coming out. And it was like there's stories over and over again about how even when she was getting all this attention, like, she was so shy about it, and it made her, she kept trying to like talk about her other Mouseketeers and all of these things. She was just so sweet about it that no one could hate her, you know, no matter what happened. And that, I think, is what actually got her as far as it did before she decided to just sort of give up doing show business and focus on her family.
Well, clearly, just judging from your reaction, Annette Funicello was in a major part of the research that you did. Now, for the guys listening in the audience, tell us on the roll call about Spin and Marty.
Oh, I love Spin and Marty. I have to say, this is one of my favorite parts of the book. And now, I didn't originally watch the show, so it was interesting to me to see like what I was drawn to. And I understand why so many fans loved the show. I watched the entire thing on DVD. It is available. A little slow by modern standards, but incredibly sweet and endearing and fun. It was about these boys who hang out on a ranch for like summer camp, and they're very opposite, Spin and Marty. You know, Spin is kind of the cool kid, and Marty was this uptight rich kid who had to sort of learn to adapt to this life on the ranch. And the one of the sweetest things about this story, I think, is the fact that the boys who played them, Tim Considine and David Stollery, were lifelong friends. They were friends before they started the show. They had known each other from auditions. They obviously were friends while they were on the show, and they remained in touch and both got out of show business. Tim now is a writer, and David designs cars for a living. But what's kind of sweet is that Tim does a lot of sports and automotive writing, and he's written several times about David, which I just think is the nicest sort of full circle, lifelong friendship kind of story you could possibly have of two opposite guys. They were kind of a lot like their own characters. And I just loved these men when I met them. And I kind of developed a weird, this is kind of strange, but I developed a weird, like, retroactive crush on Spin, too, watching it. I thought, like, I would totally be into Spin if I were a teenage girl watching this at the time.
That's amazing. We're talking to Jennifer Armstrong, everybody, author of the book Why? Because We Still Like You, An Oral History of the Mickey Mouse Club. And I'm not going to give away all of the secrets in the book, but the book does uncover some of the behind-the-scenes shenanigans of the Mouseketeers. So if you want to find out what the prepubescence of the 1950s were doing, you want to pick up this book as well. Jennifer, I know you're on deadline here, so I want to let you go. But before I do, if people are interested in what they've heard you say, or they want to learn more about you, learn more about the book, where would you direct them to go on the internet?
Well, I've got a website where everything is. It's JenniferMArmstrong.com.
JenniferMArmstrong.com, and that's where you'll find all of the information about Why? Because We Still Like You, the oral history of the Mickey Mouse Club. Jennifer, thank you so much for being our guest here on Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. We'll talk to you down the road.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks. Take care.